Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. More than 1,000 people across the country have been sickened by salmonella in an outbreak that began last May. At first, it seemed that the culprit was tomatoes, raw tomatoes, and not just any tomato, but particular tomatoes. Then, in mid-July, the FDA announced that it had traced this infection to chili peppers that were grown in Mexico. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about foodborne illness and why it is that it is so difficult to track. And our guest for the program is Dr. Sandra Hoffman from the Washington, D.C.-based group Resources for the Future. This is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that does research on environmental energy and natural resource issues. She is, by her training, an agricultural economist, and among other things, is interested in issues involving food safety, many others as well. And if you're interested in Resources for the Future, by the way, they do have a website, so you can go to www.rff.org and find out more about them. And as we talk this morning with Sandra Hoffman, questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to use is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the internet, either way, you can use our toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief just so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep moving along, but anybody's welcome to call. Dr. Hoffman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you this morning.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. Just as a way to start, there are a number of basic questions that we want to try to talk about. But first, our case study here kind of is that the current outbreak, which I understand is in a sense still going on because apparently there's still people or still reports coming in of people getting ill. On the one hand, I think that you would have to say that because it's not easy to track down the source of something like this, the fact that apparently we have identified, or at least the government says it believes that it has identified the source, you'd have to give them points on that. However, there are a lot of people who the question is, why did it take so long? We have people that were told to stay away from tomatoes and may still have been eating the thing that was the problem. And we've got a lot of very unhappy tomato growers who are all raising questions about, this did start in May, and now it wasn't until I guess third week of July before the government said, okay, now we really think we have this nailed down. So is this an example of how the system can work, or is this an example of how the system has a lot of weak points?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I would say that this has not been probably CDC's and the public health department's finest hour in terms of an investigation. If you'll think back to the spinach outbreak in California a few years ago, that went much more cleanly and rapidly. But I think it does illustrate, it's a great case to illustrate some of the systemic issues that we're facing in public health surveillance generally for infectious disease in this country, and in particular food safety. And I think it's it really illustrates some of the challenges that we're facing in our system that need to be addressed. One part of the issue here is, I think it might help to walk through how a food safety outbreak is identified and investigated.
Mm-hmm.
So usually a food safety outbreak is defined as two or more people becoming ill from the same food source. So first of all, you have to figure out whether that's happening. And it usually, you first get the sense that it's happening when people start showing up at a doctor's office with symptoms. So if you think about foodborne illness, when you get sick, how many times do you go to the doctor's office? So there's an initial kind of delay and problem with getting things reported. then there has to be a recognition, then there has to be reporting by the doctor of this as a foodborne illness. So the doctor has to recognize that it's a foodborne illness and not the flu or, you know, something, you know, something else that may be causing diarrheal illness, swimming pools or swimming somewhere out in the lake or something. And they need to recognize it as a foodborne illness and then report it to their local health authority. That local health authority then reports to CDC. And CDC is constantly monitoring reports of diarrheal illness to try to identify patterns. And so what has to happen is that there has to be, you know, kind of a mapping that starts to show up hot spots of we're getting a lot of this kind of illness coming in. And also recognition that it's connected with a particular food. So once there's kind of a heightened awareness at the local level and or CDC that there may be a problem, then investigation really starts. But if you think about it, by this time, some time has gone by. You know, you've eaten something. It may take 1 to 5 days for you to actually get sick. It takes some time, a few days pass while public health authorities are starting to see multiple cases come up so that they finally recognize that, we do have a problem. And then the investigation starts. And an investigation proceeds with, first of all, either local or often, if it looks serious, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta is the federal authority that has responsibility for tracking disease across the country and for investigating outbreaks of foodborne illness that cross state lines. So if it is one of these great large multi-state outbreaks, then CDC will be involved. If not, it will be a local investigation. And it starts with interviews with people who've gotten sick to try to figure out, okay, what's the likely culprit? And in a simple local case, it might be something like a chicken salad at the church potluck. Mm-hmm. And so you start to talk with multiple people who have become sick and see if there's a commonality between them. And that then can often, hopefully, will lead you to an event, maybe the church potluck, maybe the event is common consumption of a type of food like tomatoes in the early investigations in this case. And at that point then, public health authorities will want to identify people who have eaten similar foods but not gotten sick as well as those who have, and that is to help identify. And then with that, they can do a statistical comparison of those two groups and say, okay, was it really tomatoes that's causing this or not? I'm not clear, actually, as to why this investigation got so bogged down, but I can tell you a bit about why it's likely that tomatoes and jalapenos later became involved. They think that they've traced the major source of either the tomatoes or jalapenos to production in Mexico in this case. And I think you have to think about the process by which food gets into the market today to understand how this can become quite a complex thing to investigate. Tomatoes are produced in northern Mexico or in Florida or in California. They're harvested from a field. In a lot of our large distribution systems, they'll be collected at a sorting and processing place where they're sorted into types of grades of produce. At each of these stages, if there's some produce that's been contaminated with a bacteria or a virus, that can spread around to the other produce that it becomes contaminated with. You know, one bad apple spoils the bushel, and that is what can happen and does happen. And that kind of sorting and repacking goes on multiple times before produce finally reaches your grocery shelf. The first packer may do a coarse cut, then a wholesaler may come in and say, you know, I need this many of this grade of tomato or jalapeno or apples or whatever it may be. and there'll be a resorting. And each of those resortings, you can see how you can that bad apple could get moved around and contaminate other good apples. An increasingly national and international distribution system on food, contaminated product can get dispersed fairly widely, fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. They're still thinking it may be both tomatoes and jalapenos, and that the contamination probably took place in one of these in the course of packing and repacking the product. But you can see how it can become difficult then to figure out that, say, in this case, for instance, all but about 4 or 5 states have had incidents of illness associated with this particular strain of Salmonella. And so it's very, very widely dispersed across the country, and you can see how it would become difficult to start to identify which tomatoes are, you know, which illnesses are actually associated with a single outbreak, because you Hello.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was about to plunge in here and maybe ask some follow ups. I just wanted to make sure that I didn't want to interrupt.
Well, for example, something you could see is Montana had one case, Iowa had 2 cases reported with this, Utah had 2, Illinois has 116 cases, Texas 508. In those states with low counts, what's going on is either variability in the quality of the local public health system, that they may just not be getting reported. So the fact that we're seeing, you know, 116 in Illinois is partially because Illinois has a pretty decent public health system. But it's also reflective of where the produce is being shipped to from the contaminated source. And in this case, it was quite widely dispersed across the country.
So all of this, what it says is that we have the process for tracking this is really complicated, and that there are many steps, and you're relying on from the get-go realizing that there is a problem, but then you're thinking, well, is this a local problem? So at least I guess people should appreciate just how difficult it is to determine what's going on. What is the problem? How widespread is it? What's causing it? And where did that thing come from?
I'd say that's the situation. The other thing I would say is that the number of multi-state outbreaks appears to have increased in recent years. But part of what's going on, there are 2 things going on. One is there probably is an increase in these large multi-state outbreaks because we've seen an increasingly nationalized and also international supply chain. You know, back in the 1950s or 1960s, you know, most of your tomatoes were probably produced within a fairly close range of where they're being eaten. Mm-hmm. And today, of course, most of the produce consumed in the U.S. is being produced in California, Arizona, Florida, and about 30% is coming from international sources. So we're shipping from concentrated points across the country, so that you can start to see, and you would expect to see, an increased multiple state involvement in disease outbreaks. But the other thing that's also going on is that probably for about the last 10 years, with advances in genetics, they're actually able to identify the particular strain of bacteria that's causing an outbreak and genetically fingerprint it. So that you'll hear about, in this case, you heard about Salmonella St. Paul. Well, it's a particular strain of Salmonella that is genetically identified as unique, And that enables CDC to say, well, this may be salmonella, but it wasn't from the same source. So it helps them identify the source. And so I think part of what's happening is that because of this new genetic fingerprinting system called PulseNet, that we're now able to identify multi-state outbreaks as multi-state outbreaks coming from a common source, whereas before they may have been occurring and we didn't recognize them as occurring.
Yeah, and that's how, in this particular case, what they could actually do by using this kind of DNA fingerprinting is they could actually say, we have a jalapeno grown in this particular place or a prostatus in this particular place that has the same strain of salmonella on it as the one that has been implicated in this particular outbreak.
That's right. And we can say it's the same one that we found on tomatoes because we can genetically identify it. And I think the, you know, I think this has kind of two impacts. One, I think for most of us, it's kind of, it's a sense of, oh my gosh, the food system is becoming less safe. And there are ways in which that's probably true. So the downside is, I think, an increased sense of anxiety. But on the upside, being able to do this really gives us a lot better information base on figuring out how to actually improve food safety. So if we can actually figure out where problems are arising, we can start to try to figure out why they're arising. And we couldn't do that before without this kind of information. So that's, I see, is really the hopeful piece in this whole process.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just take a moment here to introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus for anyone who might have tuned in since we started out. We're talking with Dr. Sandra Hoffman. She is a fellow with Resources for the Future. This is a Washington, D.C.-based research organization that does work on a number of issues, environmental, energy, natural resource issues. And she is an agricultural economist by her training, and she is interested in a number of things. Food safety is one of them. And we're talking about this most recent outbreak of salmonella that started back in May and has now continued through the summer. The CDC and the FDA believe that they have found the cause, but a lot of people have raised questions about the system that we have for food safety and asked a good basic question, and that question being, is this system as good as it can be, or could it be made better so that we could more quickly determine what was going on and so that we could then give people accurate information about what was causing the problem so they could avoid that and not get sick. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, a moment ago, you pointed to something that I think that some people would say is really a really important change in the way we eat or in what we eat, and that is that more of the food that we consume every day was grown, who knows where, was not grown close to us, as it would have been the case, but has been grown in Florida or Arizona or California, or maybe has been grown outside the United States. As you said, something like now, about 30% of the food that we eat is grown outside of the United States. And even if it's grown in the United States, it's grown some distance away. So I wonder, does this mean that should we expect this kind of problem, that is an outbreak of foodborne illness that has this kind of pattern, that is maybe could be affecting large numbers of people, various states, do you think that we should expect to see this happen more often?
I think we'll continue to see it happen. I'm not sure if it will increase. I'm pausing here because I'm trying to remember the statistics on. I don't think I know the statistics on outbreaks. I don't have that at my fingertip at the moment. I don't know that I would expect to see it increasing, but I think I will take that back. I think if as we see imports increasing, we have a good chance of seeing it increase. I think on the domestic front, there's not a clear reason why it would increase, but I think the major message is that the situation isn't what it could be or what is desirable, and that there is significant need for improvement. You know, foodborne illness is still, it's not coronary illness in terms of incidence, but it's still a significant problem in the U.S. About, as you were saying, about 76 million people a year get foodborne illness. Well, that's one in four people in the U.S. It's a little less than one in four people in the U.S. population will get a foodborne illness each year. And for those who have been lucky enough not to have one that's moderately serious, you may not think that this is a big deal, but even a moderate case can knock you out of work for a week. And you may not, there were things I was surprised to learn about foodborne illness, the seriousness of it as I got into this. There, if you'll remember to the E. coli case, E. coli spinach outbreak, there are types of foodborne illness like E. coli 0157 that can actually cause very serious immediate impacts. That one can cause liver failure, and there are 5,000 deaths a year that are attributed to foodborne illness. But the other thing, the other things that can happen is we're learning that infections in general can contribute to coronary illness. So part of the incidence of coronary illness may be associated with infections because it inflames the blood vessels and tissues, and it can contribute to inflammation that contributes to coronary illness. It also can contribute to arthritis. So there are chronic conditions that are either exacerbated or can be started by an infectious event. Mm-hmm. So it's a serious problem to be addressed. And I think the solutions, there are really some systemic problems that we have with both our domestic and our international regulatory systems. I think we have to address those if we're going to hope to improve things.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Why don't we do that? I want to also tell other people who are listening that questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455 is the number if you are in Champaign, Urbana, here where we are. There is also a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call, and that is 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Eureka and on line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to address both the problems that you've been mentioning and the possible solutions. I think it is a systemic problem, as you've mentioned, and as the guest said, it's increasingly because of our national and international food system and the process by which food gets to us with multiple handlings, sortings, processings, and if one thing is contaminated, they all are. And I see that as a huge problem, and I work with a lot of farmers in our local area between Peoria and Bloomington, where we're promoting more local farms producing local food and selling it directly to people, where there's pretty much one person handling it between the farmer and the consumer, and that's the farmer. I would like to think more about that as a solution. And when I just heard the guest say something about regulatory problems with the regulatory system, I agree there's big problems. But the thing that's frightening me and the people I work with is that the regulatory system might come clamping down on everyone uniformly and really putting our small farmers, who are the safest food producers, out of business. And they're the most traceable and the most limited, if there were a problem, limited in scope. I work with the Illinois Department of Public Health. I asked how many outbreaks of foodborne illness there were from local sources, and they at first got back to me and said zero. They could find a record of none. And then they got back to me and said, well, there was one 10 or 12 years ago with apple cider. So, you know, the record of you know, foodborne illnesses in Illinois, you know, from local food sources so far is very small. Of course, it's because it's a small percentage of our food. But I would say if we're really concerned about food for the future and resources for the future, we should be thinking about promoting our local food systems.
Okay. Well, I expect Dr. Hoffman, you would agree.
I do and I don't, because I also know what it means in terms of limitations in diet. So while I think that can be a good alternative, you know, I grew up in Iowa, and so I'm familiar with what the Upper Midwest faces in terms of growing conditions, and I think there is an issue about about consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables being a really important part of improving overall health and what that means for seasonal consumption.
I'm not an all or nothing person. I enjoy my citrus as well. And, you know, the limitations in diet, I think that, you know, nobody's saying that I want 100% of all of my food here. I'm just saying that especially in our 6 months of growing season, we could have a much safer access to food if we just promoted that more. And, you know, actually I do eat year-round locally, but that's because I have brothers and sisters and neighbors, and we store a lot of food and put up a lot of food, so it is possible 12 months, but I'm not expecting everyone to do that. And I think, you know, it's something that we just need to promote, even if it is only for 3 or 6 months of the year.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm sure. Any further response you'd like to make, Dr. Hoffman?
I haven't seen any kind of data, particularly on relative safety on local versus large, non-local. So I don't think there's really much more that I have to add there.
Well, let me ask you this question then. I think that some people would argue that what we need to be doing is more inspection at wherever along the line you can do this, whether you can actually take a look at food that's in the field or that has just come out of the field, or doing inspection. If part of the problem is that we have produce that may be coming from, say, several different fields, but what happens is it's going to some kind of central processing facility where it all kind of gets mixed up and has a chance to bump into each other. And that, so there's a possibility for cross-contamination someplace like that. So maybe what we need to do is we need to look more closely and have more regular inspection of those kinds of facilities. I suppose mm-hmm. The argument would be all the way along the chain, mm-hmm. from the field to the point of sale, I guess, that there ought to be more, we ought to be doing more checking just to make sure that we don't have a problem.
Well, I would agree that we need to be doing more checking. I think the thinking on this has, what I would take some issue with is perhaps inspection. And how to explain this properly. I think there's a sense in the meat industry, we have a mandated inspection process, but it's not a very, it's a very old inspection process dating back to 1906, and it's not a very effective inspection process. We require continuous inspection of all meat packing plants, and so literally there is a USDA inspector watching the meat line go by 24 during the entire period it's in operation. We do need checks and controls throughout the entire system, but we need to think about it in terms of prevention and creating processing systems and hazard control systems that prevent that produce from getting contaminated in the first place, prevent it from spreading to other produce. And whether that involves, it probably will not involve an inspector looking at each tomato, mm-hmm. but it probably will involve every processor developing plans on how they can prevent that kind, either initial or contamination or spread of contamination. And inspection in the sense that I think more the sense that we're used to it in OSHA of inspectors making sure that people are implementing those plans and that those plans are actually working. So while you may not have an inspector in every tomato field every day, you should have, there should be, we should be working towards having farm management systems that are taking into account preventing contamination and have regular, you know, a regular way of monitoring that you're not getting contamination, and that should be a regular part of the farming process. And there will need to be some kind of government role and oversight to make sure that those systems are in place and are functioning properly. So it's a little different way of thinking about inspection than I think most people think of. Mm. one of the places where I think this is going to become much more complicated and increasingly important is in the area of imports. The volume of imports is increasing. It's very diverse. It shifts and changes rapidly, fairly rapidly over time. And there I'm thinking more processed foods than probably fresh fruits and vegetables in terms of rapid changes over time. If we were just to rely on border inspection, which I think is people's kind of first reaction, we need to have more inspectors at the border, I don't think we're going to make ourselves safer. What we have to be working towards is working on making sure that importers into the country can either have processes in place to make sure that their suppliers are providing safe food, working with foreign countries to make sure that the processes that exporters to the U.S. are using meet our standards in terms of prevention of contamination. And, yes, there also needs to be a role for inspection in the border in terms of quality control to make sure to spot check and make sure that these systems are actually functioning properly. But I think it's going to be that kind of a system control and prevention rather than product, you know, than inspecting each piece of product that's coming through the border, because the volume's just too high.
Okay, let's talk with someone else here in Urbana. Line one.
Hello. Excuse me.
Yes.
Good morning. I have a question about a contaminated tomato. Is the contamination simply outside the skin? Is it taken care of by just peeling the tomato?
It depends. It can start there, but it can enter the tomato if there's any kind of break in the tomato.
Well, that would be obvious.
Yeah.
But with a good tomato, you could just peel it and you're safe.
Yes and no. It can enter through the stem scar.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So in general, I would say with produce, the advice that people are being given, in general, when we're not in this kind of outbreak situation, is simply to wash your produce under kind of tepid running water. Not cold, because if you can imagine a warm tomato being hit by cold water, you can imagine that sucking that in if there is any break.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of lukewarm water under a flow, not soaked in something, but because, again, that water can get contaminated if you're soaking the produce in it.
Mm-hmm.
So just under running water, and just wash it with running water. And the other thing is to look at your produce for breaks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a microbiologist, so I probably have this wrong, but there tends to be a limited area. Microbes may not migrate that quickly.
Oh, mm-hmm. So even if they got under the skin, they might not get to the middle.
Right, so that if you cut away, boy, this is, I'm getting out on a limb here, but I was just listening to the Florida commissioner in public health talk about this, and it was, you know, it's a ways, you know, half inch or to an inch around the break, and you're
open. That's good to know. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And I guess if there is any doubt, it's my understanding that if you cook the tomato, you will take care of the problem here.
Absolutely.
Now, that's maybe not the news that people are, you know, they're looking forward to having fresh tomatoes and having them that way. Maybe that's not what they want to hear, but that's why the warning that was issued was for tomatoes that would be eaten raw and not for cooked product or canned product or anything like that.
That's right. Adequate cooking on, certainly on fresh fruits and vegetables, just cooking it the way we would normally cook a fruit or vegetable will kill whatever you're dealing with. But we do want to enjoy fresh fruits and vegetables, and there's no reason not to do that. Kind of the basic safety rules, they're things that I learned in 4-H, and they still hold. Wash your vegetables under flowing water. Keep meats and vegetables separate. A lot of foodborne illnesses occur because people are touching the chicken and then going over and working on the salad without having washed their hands. wash your hands properly, and that is surprisingly more involved than any of us would think. And I'd like, if you'll let me, I'd kind of like to do a little demonstration.
Sure.
So I was surprised when I started working in this area to learn that to adequately wash your hands, you really should wash them for 20 to 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And that may not seem long, but it actually is fairly long. It's kind of equivalent to singing the alphabet song or row, row, row your boat at a moderate pace for twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm going to suggest is that if your listeners want, they could start pretending they're washing their hands when I say start, and then we'll go ahead and talk, and I'll tell you when 20 seconds is up.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Okay. Well, people can do that. Go right now, go to the sink and wash your hands, and I will just reintroduce again our guest, Sandra Hoffman. She is an agricultural economist, and she works with the Washington, D.C.-based group Resources for the Future, and she's interested and does research in a number of areas, and one of those is food safety. And we are talking here about the recent salmonella outbreak that's made a lot of people across the country sick, how it is that people in places like the FDA and the CDC try to determine what the cause is, how to track it down, and then how best to get that information out to people so that then they'll act on that and then they will not get sick. Questions?
That was 30 seconds.
That was 30 seconds. Okay, so at least that long. I have also heard before people suggest the alphabet song is a pretty good one. That's one everybody knows. And if you think about how often you wash your hands and how long you do that, I think probably most of us don't. Not only do we probably not wash enough, that is enough times during the day, but we're probably actually not doing a very good job when we do it. So that's good things to keep in mind, and particularly good things to get that through to your kids.
I think that's the one thing you can do for yourself that will make the biggest difference in your personal risk.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd like to talk about, though, for us as a nation is the issue of our public health surveillance system and the need for change there, because I think it's something that we need to be aware of because it's going to require us to make some investments in it in the future. It's surprising the lack of coordination there actually is between the variability. There's a number of things. One is the variability in the quality of local and state public health systems. I think we in the Upper Midwest are fortunate in having had a commitment to good local government, and we have some of the better public health systems in the country, but that is not uniform across the country. There's a great deal of variation in the amount of effort and investment that's taken there. And the sorts of things that are involved are county public health officials who are trained properly to actually understand and monitor health conditions, maintenance of local and state public health laboratories, and the quality of staffing and equipment that's going on there. And then improving on getting a more uniform quality in our local public health system is part of it. But then there's also just some very fundamental communications issues that are not being worked out well yet between local governments in terms of information sharing, and also between local governments and CDC, which is the Centers for Disease Control, the federal disease monitoring agency, and their sharing of information back to the local governments. Part of this grows out of the history of law in this country that public health is part of the state police power, and it's probably the strongest piece of our state of the power that the state government has to protect public health and safety. And because of that, the role of the federal government in this area is legally limited. And CDC historically has viewed itself really as a research organization more than it has viewed itself a public health management organization. So it sees its role in investigating outbreaks, maintaining national level vital statistics, doing research into what the incidence of cancer is in the country, epidemiological research on not just cancer but all diseases in the country. But when it comes to like managing an outbreak of foodborne illness or an outbreak of avian influenza or a bioterrorism attack, should God forbid that happened, the onus of responding to that and actually taking action is really at the state and local level. But the problem is in, for instance, these multi-state outbreaks, there needs to be coordination nationally because they involve multiple states, and you can't get the information you need if there's not that kind of coordination. And that has been an endemic, a long-standing problem that our public health system really hasn't been addressing yet. And it's one I think most people are unaware of, but it's this problem of information sharing and coordination. And ultimately, at some level, coordinated response. And so I think that that's really something that public health officials around the country are aware of and want to work on, but it's been a very difficult issue because of the legal structure of the state and federal constitutions.
You know, there's something else that I think has come up often in some of the conversations that we've had about this, and this is the fact that the food safety system or responsibility for food safety is fragmented. It's there are basically two agencies that are responsible for food, USDA and FDA. USDA is responsible for meat and poultry, although not eggs or milk. FDA is just about everything else, except I think there are some exceptions here and there. And I think people have said the fact that the responsibility is fragmented and the fact that the kind of resources that the groups have, that the two organizations have, or the two entities have, are oddly skewed so that the group that has the biggest responsibility, which is FDA, actually gets the smallest, much smaller resources than USDA. It's all very confusing, and I think that some people have said, really, there ought to just be one. On the federal level, there ought to be one big agency that oversees all of this. Do you think that would actually make much difference?
I think it would. I mean, in fact, it's primarily USDA and FDA, but it's really dispersed. Department of Commerce takes care of seafood, and several other agencies are involved as well. So it's quite a coordination problem. I think simply putting them into a single agency, I don't think will actually address the problem. It's deeper than that. Part of the reason for the skewed distribution of funding is because USDA is still operating on effectively under the 1906 Meat Inspection Act. It's been updated several times over the last century, but the fundamental structure and requirements are still pretty much the same, and it's this continuous inspection. And having an inspector in every meat processing plant takes a lot of time and is expensive, and it takes a lot of the USDA food safety budget. And it's not clear how much that's buying us in terms of protection. So as opposed, say, to the USDA inspection, which is continuous, FDA's resources have been eroded very severely over a very long period of time, probably actually over about a 30-year period, but it's accelerated a lot in the last 10 to 15 years. And they're now at a point where they think that they probably inspect food processing facilities once every 10 years. So while part of the reason that can happen is on many food processing companies have strong internal controls, there's probably a need for greater oversight in that area as well.
Mm-hmm.
So putting them into a single agency would do would be to help enhance coordination across different foods. But what is fundamentally needed then to really make that work is a significant reform that emphasizes, again, prevention, development of requirements for systems that help assure prevention of contamination, and a system of private and public, probably, verification that the systems are functioning properly.
Yeah, I suppose I find myself wondering, too, when you talk about the fact that we do have inspectors on site in meat processing plants and that there's somebody there who is literally standing there watching the carcasses go by, I guess, yes, that person would be in the position to see generally what conditions were like in the plant, but it's not as if you could look at a carcass and see E. coli on it.
Absolutely.
So you would sort of wonder, well, what exactly does that accomplish, having that person there just standing there watching the meat go by?
Absolutely. And USDA is using some testing, but they have been kind of constrained legally under their statute from using testing as effectively as they microbial testing as effectively as they could. They wanted, for example, to have salmonella testing as a way of creating a standard for how can you know you're going to get some contamination on food. None of this is perfectly sanitary. I mean, you know, meat is a kind of a living, if not living, but it's you're not going to have it 100% clean. Mm-hmm. But there should be standards in terms of how clean is adequate to assure public health. Because you can eat some bacteria and it's not going to make you ill, but at some level it does start to cause public health problems. And they were prevented from using testing to set those standards by court interpretation of what their legal mandate is. And so it would require reform of statutes to actually be able to use testing as a standard for product quality. And that would help.
Mm-hmm. Some people have made the argument that there is a technological fix for this, that there was something that we could do to treat product so that if there is a problem, we deal with it. And I guess irradiation has been the one thing that I know has been discussed. It's something that seems to make people kind of uneasy. But the argument is that it doesn't do anything to change, that it doesn't have any impact on the food chemically. But by doing that, you could take care of the problem. Is it possible that that or anything else, that there would be some way of implementing some kind of technology to essentially to treat the food and take care of whatever bugs they might be present?
Well, it could well be that sort of thing is part of the solution. For example, on a very simple level, on fruits and vegetables, using a chlorine wash is actually part of a standard process that's often used. So, you know, dunking, washing produce. Steam pasteurization, which is a process of actually steaming the outside of a carcass, is used on pork, for example. And it's a way of making sure that after you've skinned the animal and eviscerated it, that anything that's gotten on the outside of the animal is killed. And it doesn't affect the internal part of the meat. So there are technologies that are being used all the time in terms of decontamination. And I know that irradiation has been it's just something the public really has not been willing to accept. The science I've seen on it has said that there's no health problems with it. I think that there still are some issues. I think I've seen that there's still some issues with kind of product quality and kind of changing texture or kind of product quality but not product safety kinds of concerns.
Mm-hmm. I know this is maybe this is a slightly different issue, but I think that particularly because of concerns about imports, some people have argued that we really need to have better labeling that says where product comes from. And I know that within the food industry, I think people have mixed feelings about that. Would having more, to the extent that it can, and I don't know that you can label every green bean, but to the extent that you can do that, would origin labeling be helpful?
I'm not certain that it'll help that much because it's too coarse. It doesn't really tell you. I mean, to the extent that there are countries that are real problematic actors, and the whole country is, it would help. but that's not what we tend to see. It tends to be more specific than that. So you end up really damaging trade with the entire country, and for that reason, there tend to be problems with it in our international trade talks. So I think the likelihood of us getting that is not high. And as I say, I'm not sure how much it would really improve safety because it may not be, you know, it's undoubtedly not all producers from that country, and it's not helping you really identify the problems.
Mm-hmm. And in terms, we have just about a minute or so left, but in terms of issuing warnings, as I said earlier, now the tomato growers are really unhappy, and we could understand why, that people were warned off tomatoes, and it probably was not the problem, so they've lost a lot of money.
Right.
Now, I'm sure that, though, for as far as FDA, CDC is concerned, you know, they'd say, well, we don't want people to get sick, so if we have it with some reasonable level of confidence that a certain thing is a problem, then we feel we should tell people that. I guess there, you know, how do you draw the line between trying to get that information out to the public so that people don't get sick, and also you don't want to take a chance that you're going to really damage producers of some particular commodity, and particularly if it turns out later that then that's not the problem.
Well, I can say those agencies face both of those pressures, and. At some level, I'm actually happy that they probably take their public health, even though I'm an agricultural economist, and I know what kind of impact this has on farms. I think both of those things have to be taken into account, and I'm not sure how they draw the line, but I think both agencies will tend to draw the line towards public health, just given the culture of the agencies. Part of what I try to do as an economist is to help increase the kind of information they have about the impact on, well, both on health expenses and also on production.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to jump in here simply because we're here at the end of the time. I want to say, Dr. Hoffman, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure being with you.
Great. Dr. Sandra Hoffman, she's an agricultural economist with Resources for the Future in Washington. If you'd like to find out more about the group, look at their website, www.rff.org.